Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Confident Hypnotherapist podcast. This week, I am truly delighted to have with me a trainer, speaker, author, and the most curious legend you could imagine, Richard Hill, joining me. Richard, how are you doing today?
Well, look, I'm doing much better already. Thank you so much. No, that's it's lovely of you to say, but it is testing that the title of the podcast is The Confident Hypnotherapist. A lot of pressure. Yeah.
What is it about the title that you feel is confronting here?
Got to be confident now. Got to be confident. And but it is an interesting start. Almost straight away is the joy that I've experienced over the last 15, 20 years, particularly with Ernie Rossi, which we'll talk about in a moment, I'm sure, of becoming more and more knowledgeable, more and more experienced, and more enjoying the engagement with what I don't know. Mm. So I'm terribly confident that I'm not necessarily always confident, but I'm confident that I'm not confident, but then I'm confident to be. It's a really interesting word that you've chosen for your podcast. I've been thinking about it for a while.
It was funny, actually. I think it was Rob McNeely who pointed out that there was almost a joke in the title, in the sense that,
yes,
you know, to be a confident hypnotherapist, you wouldn't focus on the fact that you're confident. And I'm glad he kind of got the joke in the title there.
Yeah, great stuff.
But going back, I wouldn't mind explaining to our viewers and our listeners a bit of our history.
Sure.
Because I first met you back in 2015 when I was studying my diploma of hypnotherapy. And I remember that you came in to teach us mirroring hands back at that point in time. And it was one of those days that I remember incredibly well, because I remember leaving it in the day being truly fascinated by what I had experienced, but also feeling so much more confident from what I had experienced too, because it felt like an approach that I was doing with someone, which in that very early stages of learning hypnosis, you kind of sometimes feel like you're doing something to someone. And this was one of those wonderful experiences where it truly was doing something with someone in that moment. So I thank you for that, because that was an experience that still has had a profound effect on me all these years later. But of course, you've written this incredible book here, Mirroring Hands, with the wonderful Ernest Rossi, and available now in all good bookstores and and on Kindle and on Audible.
Yes, indeed.
So let's jump into a big question to start off with. That, you know, what is it about mirroring hands that you think works so effectively well? Why is mirroring hands so good as a tool in a toolkit to have?
It's a question that broadens out into a couple of areas. Let me go one area, but slightly more pragmatic in its frame, is where it has flowed from, and the pedigree of this is slightly ridiculously fantastic, in the sense that Ernest Rossi, certainly, as we've been talking about, and he's probably become more well known for his scientific work, you know, looking at genes and the psychobiology of gene expression and going into quantum, as a great thinker and a great innovator of thought. But of course, he worked with Milton Erickson all through the 70s. And in fact, I was talking to Roxana Erickson Klein, Milton Erickson's daughter. And we were, I think there were three or four of us having a conversation. And somebody said, who was Erickson's most favorite student? And she said, well, actually, she talked about a few other people in the earlier years, Ravitz and some of the sorts, and said, but eventually he said, towards the latter part of his life, it was Ernie Rossi. Because Ernie came in to try and understand what Erickson was doing. And he's a very scientific sort of fella. But what emerged from Ernie's observation of Erickson over that decade, which was a decade of deterioration in Erickson, because he had post-polio, returning polio syndrome, And so much of the meticulous work that Eric's had done over the early years of trying to understand what he was doing, when he was doing it, the recordings, and of course with Ernie, it was extended again because he had this other observer, and Ernie Rossi would write them up and they would discuss. So, is it Ernie discovered that actually this work with metaphor, this work with planning, this work with strategy, because strategic therapy has come out of Erikson and through and has practiced. A lot of hypnotherapists practice strategic theory. They just don't know, perhaps the technicality of it. And that more and more of this disappeared from the overt practice that Erikson did. He was doing some of these metaphor things, but his speech was so slurred and labored that very often people didn't even hear what he was saying. Yet they still had an extraordinary experience. And I think one of the ones that Ernie particularly noticed was he used to say the classic in the early days, like there would be what we call the basic accessing question task, which is basically just fundamentally asking the client if they're ready to begin this inner work and using the hands together in that mesmeric energy, do you feel the magnetism, the pull between them? And as you, if you're ready to do the work, will you feel those hands will move together? Erikson did this practice with those hands will move together, or your hand will raise, is levitation, is one of the other practices that people are very familiar with. And Ernie did two things. One thing, he was working with the hands with somebody and he forgot to say there's a magnetic pull. And anyway, the person's hands moved anyway. And Ernie thought, hello.
What's going on here?
Well, so they're not actually acting under my suggestion or my direction at all. And then later on, as he went in and he watched people responding to Erikson, not so much clear of what he was telling them to do, but taking it on themselves, that it was almost like, I wonder what he's after me. I wonder what. Ernie simply changed that thing of your hands will move together or your arm will raise to will your hands move together? And suddenly in that little flip from a direction to a question, and what will we, I'm expanding now into a curious question, a genuine, wondrous question. Will they? I don't know. He found that people, well, one of the main things he found, there was never, ever any resistance. Because he said, will they move together? They either moved together or they didn't. And if they didn't, well, okay, then the action wasn't occurring. So it was a wonderful shift of frame from being non-directive to actually not being directive at all, but being curiously engaged in a co-created experience, of which the client was an enormously important and perhaps even the principal generator of activity, and the therapist was much more the facilitator.
Mm.
Now, just moving that concept along, so how does that work? And I was actually just talking to doing a supervision session earlier today, and Lass has just passed her exams, done a university degree, so very skillful, and she's just so worried about what she'll do when she goes into a therapy session. What will I do? And we talked to quite a bit, but fundamentally I could summarize it down. I said, how about you don't? How about you don't do? What you do is you participate and you engage in experience and you bring to that experience your knowledge as well as your self-knowledge. Because one of the most, to me, revolutionary ideas, although I don't think it's revolutionary, or it's revelationary ideas that a lot of people ascribe to but actually don't practice as much as they should, is that where did all these therapies come from? Where did asking the question or not asking the question, or curiosity, or trance, or not trance, or clean language or not clean language. Every single one, and going into psychotherapy, where did CBT, where did EMDR come from? Where did NLP come from? It came from observing human beings, looking at what their what I could you could describe as their mental health system produced, and then refined those things down, sort of took them out and refined them down, and said, oh wow, this is now a therapy. But unfortunately, it's a bit like someone taking a carburetor out of a car, improving it, refining it, understanding how it works correctly, making it a better model, but then not putting it back in the car. So what we did was sort of put our therapies and we sort of separated them. So now we have, you know, we have NLP as a totally separate form of expression to maybe some other type, maybe to psychotherapy, maybe to a, we even have hypnotherapy is broken up into sort of you have your Ellman style and your Erickson style.
Correct and the permissive and, yeah.
And all of them are not styles. They're not anything. Mm. They're individual expressions of a single human being who will require that particular facet or expression or differentiated element at some time. And the best person to tell you when they need it and who needs it is the person themselves.
Mm.
Now, that sounds like they're taking direction, taking charge. You work that out in many, many different ways, which we can talk about in a sec. But that's the most important thing. So what Mirroring Hands does, it boldly says, okay, the content is in the client. I have capacities as a therapist, and I have things that I can engage with, and I have my sensitivity and my both humanistic awareness and also my academic awareness to be able to recognize where the client is taking themselves and to be able to enhance that experience. And more importantly, I'm able to know when to step away and not interfere with the experience. So this was something that Ernie said that his observation of therapy was that the vast majority of therapists, in all their best intentions and with the warmest and deepest of heart, creating positive effects, are actually interfering with something that can be much deeper, much more profound, and much more just personally expressive. What so I better take breath.
It's okay. What you're saying reminds me, you know, as I was listening to someone speak recently, and they were talking about how quite often many therapists, when they start out, will sit with a client, and as they're engaging in the conversation in their mind, they might get caught up in a whole notion of how do I fix, how do I cure, any of those sorts of things. And in that particular presentation, he was suggesting the person, don't let go of that. Be curious instead about what you're hearing and just continue to ask what's happening for them, because that will bring up whatever it is that that person needs to express. And it's kind of echoing in what you're saying to me right now as well.
Oh, very, very much. We have an intrapersonal mental health system. We are basically organized both biologically and psychobiologically to move towards well-being. I mean, the idea is that we become, we survive and we're desirable. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a species. We'd have been wiped out ages ago. And so we have this intrapersonal system that does this. But what human beings have, and some other species as well, but certainly human beings, is we have an interpersonal mental health system. So we actually co-regulate and co-educate and co-emote. And this is terribly, terribly important in therapy, because a therapist certainly can do something in the appropriate moment and it's wonderful and necessary and fabulously effective because they're putting the contribution in. But there's also the time when they step back and allow the client who is already doing the process to keep going and maintain that. And the trick is, when do I step in and when do I step out? So what we do in Mirroring Hands is we sort of take the assumption, let's step out. And rather than being in and then having to get out of the way, let's get out of the way and actually, even to a fault, be out of the way. So one of the things that is the most important little lines or pieces of dialogue that's used through the therapy that you rarely hear in others is when there's been silence for some time, or there's the client is we're not sure what the client's doing. We'll say, is there a word or two you would like to share with me? Only if it's helpful for you, and only if you want to do so. Otherwise, would you like to just continue with your own private work? Now, that's a line put into for the therapist, because we're getting paranoid. Yes. Thinking, oh my God, nothing's been said for 10 minutes. But I spend most of my time going around the room just saying to when people are doing, practice sessions, little breakout sessions, just telling them to be quiet. And they're saying, oh, yes, but they're not saying anything. I said, but look at their face. And then they go, oh, yeah, their eyes are moving. So EMDR. Mm-hmm. I've seen this many times, people doing EMDR, mm-hmm. because EMDR, the eye movement desensitization process, is a natural thing. Francine Shapiro found she did it naturally. And it's just what we do. Now, they've taken it out and formalized it, and as soon as we formalize something, we diminish it a bit, but we don't destroy it at all. But there are so many things that are so wonderful. Almost everything that every therapy that I've ever experienced and seen and watched and learned about, I've seen people spontaneously do during a Mirroring Hands experience, which kind of is fascinating, a little freaky, but certainly gives me my own personal satisfaction that, yes, the client can, given the conditions and the appropriate circumstances and the opportunity, that they can move themselves along towards this beneficial state.
Mm. So because I'm consciously aware of the fact that there might be some people listening to this podcast who have absolutely no concept,
yes,
of what Mirroring Hands is, or what a session would look like, or how it would even run. And I know I'm aware of Elvis Costello, who said that, trying to describe music was like trying to dance to architecture. It can be perhaps a little bit challenging trying to
explain. So you're quite right. Yeah, no, you're quite right. So what it's doing is it's utilizing and expanding what used to be called ideomotor responses. And people still use those, where they get a yes, no finger, and David Cheek, going back to those sort of days, which hand levitation is an ideomotor response. And I loved it when I said to Ernie, I said, why don't you just do the levitation? He said, oh, it didn't work all the time. Oh, Erickson had terrible trouble sometimes. And I went, oh, my God. I thought this was just sort of like a lay down mazair. Erickson says your hand goes up and up it goes.
Everyone did it, yeah.
Yeah, but apparently, you know. So what it's using, Ernie extended that to ideodynamic.
Mm.
So it could be a movement, it could be a feeling, it could be a sense of a mental sense of color or shape or a visual image. The idea is, but it is something that emerges out of the system rather than something that is cognitively directed. Can you see a door? Oh, yes, I see a door. It's big and brown and blue and green, which is great, but it's like, I wonder what you see.
Mm.
And I said, oh, it's a door. Anyway, but let's getting back to that fundamental framework is shifting the brain. Now, there's lots of argument about what hypnosis is, what it's not, what hypnotherapy is. But fundamentally, there's an inner mechanism. There's a set of internal mechanisms that is beneath our conscious awareness that organize our body and produce beneficial And that also, they produce bad things, but let's not talk about those, but they produce beneficial results. And a really simple example of an idiodynamic response, rather from an internal, so an idiodynamic is from the idea downwards. So from a bottom up, from an internal self-organized resolution producing you with an answer, is that two or three times a day, people will say, I'm hungry. Mm. Now, that's the conscious awareness. But that conscious awareness is incredibly blunt and dull. I mean, what for? You know, for how much protein, how much carbohydrates, how much B6? You know, you don't sort of sit there and say, oh, I need a spoonful of folate. And you have this very blunt, conscious, cognitive sense of something that stimulates you to do something, to have some response in the hunger thing, to get up and go and get something out of the fridge. It's exactly the same with symptoms. There, anything that you can be consciously aware of is a blunt, dull, minimally stimulating message to push you into doing something. And that includes depression, that includes, you know, PTSD responses, anxiety, all those various aspects. So what's going on underneath? We're all aware of the sort of the tip of the iceberg type of program. So if you say to yourself, if you give the idea that I want to make a connection with this inner processing system, and I don't want to just sort of muck up the whole game by thinking about it or getting too cognitive or anything. Can we just have these idiodynamic responses that are coming to us? And people have seen it. We can direct people to say yes and no. But what if you don't direct them at all? Now, in the Mary Enhance process, I don't know if everyone's out there, but if you just pull your hands up, we're all a bit stuck with stuff with processes, but in a formalized process, you might say to someone, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, pull your hands. Almost all the time now, it just spontaneously emerges from therapies with me. People are just doing things. I say, oh my God, the hands are going, what's in this one and what's in that one? But if we're just sitting there, and even now as we just sit in this interesting space of either people watching or they're just listening, just bring your hands up in front of you, a foot or so apart, palms up, and just see if you can focus your attention. And we all know that hypnosis, and I think therapeutic consciousness, is when there is a state of attention. So you can't be distracted and help yourself. You need to focus. So you focus on your hands. You look in and really start to notice them. Notice the wrinkles. Notice the length of the fingers. Notice the jewelry that you have or you don't have. I always look at my hands and see more wrinkles, which is a shame. And then as you just sit there, if you feel those hands really present, I wonder if you might take a moment as you're listening or watching just to wonder whether one hand feels different than the other. I wonder, is it a bit, maybe it's a bit cooler or warmer, depending on which hand you're noticing. And I'm not asking you to think about it and choose which one. I'm just asking you to notice. I've done this 870 billion million times, and my God, this hand is cooler and it's a bit heavier. And I didn't ask for it. And I wonder if anybody out there has just had that little experience. Or maybe they had a twitch, they had a little finger twitch or something that just made one hand distinct from the other. Now, that's the beginning process. That's it. That's the induction. In mirroring hands, you never ask people to close their eyes or keep them open. never ask them. Some people don't even raise their hands. They just leave them down and just do it in there and visuals.
But even then, my hands are like this, and I could still feel as you were asking those questions what the response was for them.
Yeah. Isn't that lovely? Because you've experienced it before. Mm-hmm. So you're going, I don't have to formalize, but, oh, damn it. Yeah, there it is. And I mean, I do it at the traffic lights because we have traffic lights that are really slow. And I'll just do it while I'm standing there. Which hand? Oh, that one. And I'll put all my crappy stuff. I say, I don't know what's crappy, but I'm sure there is. Put that out there. And I want what's good here. And I'll throw just very, very simple processes of daily management. So we've got that sense already that we know we've changed. We've got an altered reality. We've got a focus of attention because the one, but we perceive it to be. So therefore we've altered reality. So there's a number of things already going on. People will spontaneously have closed their eyes. There's all kinds of stuff happening. And what we're looking then is a very simple version of the opposites. And certainly this has been talked about and put into parts therapy where they'll say, put one, you know, put this part here and put that part there. The difference in the mirroring hands approach is that we really trust this idea that the client, given the opportunity and the appropriate circumstances, they will be the best arbiters of what to put forward. Now, I just say, sure, it goes on all kinds of different directions, but let's not talk about the complicated versions. Let's talk about the fundamental framework of it. And so you might have something like in therapy, like anxiety or pain, but you also might have something like overeating or smoking. Now, even still, in mirroring hands, I won't say put your smoking in that hand or put your anxiety in that hand. I'll say, I wonder what it is about that anxiety or wonder what it is about that thing you do you don't want to do. Is that which hand might be receiving that? They then choose. And sometimes it's fairly mundane and goes the way it goes. Oh, I could feel my anxiety. It was this. And sometimes they're doing things saying, oh, wow, it's not that thing at all. Oh, what I'm starting to feel now or what I'm starting to see now. And they've immediately, it's the first example of them bypassing your beautifully well-intentioned interference to help them do the job that they thought they came to, but then actually they came to do something entirely different. Now, this is what some people call, I mean, there's sort of clean language where you tend not to impose things and content-free. But as I say, it's full of content. The client's got it. You just don't know what it is. And until you do, shut up. And when you do, shut up. There's a beautiful, won't remember because you were off with the Pixies at the time doing your own thing, but there's a beautiful bit of footage I've got of a workshop you were with me. And honest to God, your hands were doing all kinds of movement. I don't know what you were working on. You did, I think you discussed it briefly afterwards. There was a woman sitting next to you who was also doing all kinds of stuff. There was a great deal of passiveness. I would say that there was not a word spoken for 15 or 20 minutes. Yet afterwards, there was a host of enjoyment and pleasure and benefit that was shared. I don't know whether you remember that session, but I've watched it a number of times and you were particularly, there was not a moment there that I thought, oh, gee, I wonder if Lawrence is still working.
I've been to a couple of trainings of yours now, so it could be.
Yeah, so it depends.
But the first training I actually had of yours was with a class that I wasn't normally with. So I remember walking into that class thinking, I'm not going to know anyone. This is going to be an interesting experience in itself. Yeah. But then to be able to have that wonderful, the naturalness, organicness of mirroring hands, I think it broke down any of those barriers I might have had walking into that class and allow me to connect with those people to the point where trading numbers at the end of the day
Yes. Yeah.
It's great.
We're all Aussies. This is what the Americans were astounded at. You know, people say to me, Richard, how do you know all these people? I said, well, first of all, I went there. Then I walked up and said, g'day. And which I did with Ernest Ross here. But I was of suitable simpatico with the work they were doing. Mm. And the very complicated scientific aspects of it. So I think what's beautiful about the nature of the mirroring hands process, first of all, its approach is applicable all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter what sort of techniques you do. But it allows for the experience to emerge first, and then the therapist can move in, but I must admit, I've never had to.
Mm.
I've never had to. There was a wonderful experience I had where a woman was just doing a demonstration in Melbourne. She just got one of the students got up and she began to work. And then it was more or less, I said, I don't know what you would like to work on now, but I wonder if what you need to work on wants to express itself, was to come out into one of the hands. And she began to do stuff. And it ended up being really deep. It was going back to a traumatic experience time she had when in her early childhood, where she caught an infectious disease and was put into hospital and was isolated and nobody could get in. And she was so angry at her mother and angry at the nursing staff. And she'd held that anger and trauma, you know, too young to realize that it was actually all for the good in the long run. And she still had it, and she did this in the demonstration. Thank you very much. That's the trouble. It's lovely doing these demonstrations where you've got a script or you've got a particular purpose and everybody does exactly the same things. You do a mirroring hands demonstration.
Not sure where it's going to go.
So anyway, she started to remember this thing, and she starts eliciting words occasionally. She'll say, oh, the bastards, look at them. They're just there. And I'm going, right. I was just there participating, maintaining the opportunity, maintaining the safety, using words of yes, and the courage you have to maintain. Can you maintain this just a little longer as you benefit? These dialogues, we talk about all this in the book. And also I've got the video training program, which I'll tell in a minute. And she went, and then she began, tears were flowing as often happens. And of course, that terribly uncomfortable thing when it gets really heavy is the nose starts to run. And it's like, ooh, poor Dunning. So I just grabbed a tissue from somebody in the room, and they had one there, but I didn't give it to her. Again, this thing that Ernie had drummed into me, keep out of it.
Mm.
If she wants a tissue, she'll open her eyes and say, give me a tissue. Or whatever. So I just held the tissue up in the space.
Mm.
And anyway, at some point, she took the tissue. And in fact, one of the students said, oh, your hand just moved in slightly at the same moment she moved hers. Did you think about that? And I said, no. So there's that co-created, co-trance.
There was an unconscious movement.
Yeah, we were mirror neuron engaged. Anyway, I moved the tissue. She took the tissue. She blew her nose. It actually was a revealing. It totally was that one of those aha moments, because she said, oh, my God, I can blow my own nose. And that's what I've been doing all my life, saying you've got to make up for not blowing my nose. And putting them in the isolation and demanding that everybody else care for her. And she had to be looked after first. So she, and in that moment, her life changed. It was just one of those extraordinary things. But afterwards, somebody said to her, I said, that tissue, what was it, the tissue? She said, it was the weirdest thing. I could see it floating in midair in front of me. Her eyes were fully closed.
Mm.
I just reached out and grabbed it when the moment was right. Imagine if I had been beautifully caring, sensitive, and engaged and not wanted her to be embarrassed by having, you know, snot rolling down her nose and into her mouth. I mean, and I'd given her that tissue before she was ready to blow her own nose.
It would have changed the entire course of that.
Yeah. For her. Still could have been terrific for her. She still could have got great stuff.
But the breakthrough was her grabbing that tissue and blowing her own nose.
When she wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a great lesson. They're not always as tempestuous as that.
Well, I remember one story of yours where there was a lady who had been to several therapists for a particular issue, and she kind of came into your office, I believe, kind of saying, we've got 15 minutes or something.
No, she was great. She was great. Because our front door is open. You come in and my room, has a sliding door. But anyway, she just knocked on the door and I looked up and went, oh, hello. And she said, yes, look, I'm off to see my psychiatrist. I write about it in the introduction to the book. I'm off to see another psychiatrist or something. I've seen everybody. I've read everything. There's nothing you could tell me that would be any new. But I'll give you 60 minutes because your poster out the front looks interesting.
That's always how you select.
Obviously. So anyway, so she went off and she came back. And this is this other aspect of what I'm starting to do a lot more, trying to do a lot more deeper work on, what we call being client responsive. So we've learned how to be client centered. And I think a lot of our work, even when we're being directive, you know, the client's the important thing. They've come for something. We're trying to get to what they're on about when, you know, we're not being terrible people. But to be client responsive is where you actually wait until it comes from the client and then you reflect it back. You like feedback through a system. It goes back. And sometimes it can put you into improvisational hazards. Anyway, so she's doing the work. She spontaneously started doing stuff with her hands. So I said, you know, show me the hands, bring them out. So we started to work. She spontaneously went into, I would say, at least a medium trance. Her eyes were down, her head was down, the breathing and various things were going. But she would pop her head up every now and again and go, look at a watch and say, you've got 25 minutes to go. And then go straight back into trance. It was interesting. And then at one stage, we'd been going for, I suppose, about 30 minutes or something. And she looked up to me because obviously something was happening. Obviously, there was stuff going on, and there was. We won't go into the detail. It was quite private. But she looked up at me and she said, what are you doing? And it just resonated in my head. You've just told me that you don't trust anybody. Nobody knows. You've seen everything. There's nothing I could know that would help you. So if I had said, oh, I'm doing this incredible process that was developed by Ernest Rossi and Milton Erickson, and that she would have just gone, oh, another friggin', you know. And honest to God, Lawrence, it was so scary. I just looked her in the eye with all genuineness and I said, I don't know. And she looked at me and I said, it's just happening. And she went, okay, and went back. And we did have an extraordinary revelation and we figured out why she'd had all this therapy. Fundamentally, she had a mask. So what we developed was this persona, and her hands had eventually moved into this mask that she is, this, you know, brazen thing, was over the top and protecting. But what it was she was unrevealed. So nobody knew who she was. And I said, I wonder if the mask can take a rest now. I still didn't say, let's bring those parts together. I still didn't say, now integrate. I still didn't give her what would have been a very well-intentioned therapeutic process. So I wonder. And then it was up to her. And so she sort of relaxed her hands. And what the therapist had been doing all the years was trying to repair the mask. But you can't get rid of your armor. I mean, it was stupid. So she resisted. And that was there was a process. I just didn't give her anything to resist against. I didn't give her any therapeutic domination or even excessive kindness. And that was a big lesson, big lesson.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of client that would freak most people out, if I'm completely honest, to have someone look up and go, what are you doing? I know.
Freak the hell out of me.
It would be the thing of nightmares for some therapists.
Yeah. And I think this is very true. Right? So that not all types of open therapies are for every therapist.
Mm.
I think this is something you grow into, you develop in your own way. I think your own humanity, the fact that, you know, I'd spent 35 years doing other things, I think was very helpful, because people would be sitting there with life experiences that I was well aware of. You know, I had a strong, not only empathetic engagement with, but a personal, like, oh, I've done that. But of course, realizing they'd had their own experience. So it is very personal. And I still think that some of these, that all therapies have a beneficial effect, have the potential to have a beneficial effect. But sometimes they don't have a lasting beneficial effect. Sometimes they only have a beneficial effect within the framework that it was constrained to. But something like the mirroring hands process really is one of the only ones I've seen that honors the client's genius, respects the therapist's capacities, but engages with the truth of what they create together. And someone put a metaphor I listened to the other day saying, oh, yes, the client is in the driver's seat, but the therapist has the map. And I'm going, no, that's person-centered. And, in fact, that's actually not person-centered. Rogers didn't say that, but that's the way it's generally practiced. They're driving the car, but we give them a therapy to help. And I said to my wife, I said, no, the client is in the driver's seat and they have the map, but they can't see it, they can't find it, they don't know they've got it. They've got it upside down, and the therapist is in that moment to point, oh, there it is, or what about there? And I've had many people that I've sort of gone, oh, what about that road there, using the metaphor, and they'll go, oh, yeah, that's where I should go on this other road, and they'll go completely in the opposite direction of what I was implying, which is interesting. But having said that, do I occasionally get quite directive with people? Yeah, because they tell me. And so they ask me to. So I'm responsive and I'm quite directive, but always open to when I let go, to when they're able to let go. So sometimes people aren't ready to have therapy, to have open-ended therapy like that. And so I do have to respect that. No, I don't want to imply to people that suddenly I just have people sitting down. I don't do anything. I kick them out after an hour and then I say how wonderful it was, you know.
Mm. Yeah. I'm even just thinking from a therapist's perspective, though, when we look at how a lot of hypnotherapists are taught nowadays, they're kind of taught, you know, let's do parts and let's do, you know, regression and let's do all these different kind of processes that generally are quite directive. You know,
yeah,
part that does this and now, you know, thank that part and all that sort of thing. Whereas what's really brilliant about this, as you mentioned, you kind of set things up, but then you get out the way.
Yeah.
And that almost goes against what a lot of
it does. It goes against that. It's basically saying, don't you do anything.
Mm.
Give the client an opportunity and circumstances and see what they do.
Mm.
Are they going into parts? Good. Are they going into a regression? Good. Go with them, support them, you know, have the knowledge that can make sure that they have the most positive experience. Because clearly if they were able to do, you know, parts integration, or if they were able to do regression stuff, then they wouldn't be in therapy. They'd have done it spontaneously. You know, I've got a a client at the moment that's working with sexuality. And there's a bunch of things. There's about four or five things that we could actually, you know, clearly delineate that are interfering with her ability to get it right, to get the truth in her own sense of things. And, you know, religion is in there, and a whole bunch of messy things. But I don't know if anybody's seen the show Atypical, which was one of the Netflix or
something. I have not seen it.
Oh, you've got to look at it. It's so fantastic. He's autistic. And, of course, he's atypical. But everybody's atypical. Everybody's weird. You don't know the so it's fantastic. But there's this beautiful other character, and she ends up realizing that she's bisexual. And in that realization, she has a great breakthrough and then has a sense of truth about herself and so on and so forth. But she does it all just through life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see the therapy, the therapeutic events that are leading to what's going on, and that a therapist may have helped her experience as she went along. But this is the whole point. Therapy has been existent in our social experience for millennia.
Mm.
And what we've got to do is we've got to stop screwing it up. And our modern culture has a lot of things that interfere with our capacity to be mentally healthy. It really is difficult, as we are with our physical health, with pollutions and various other things. We have in the winner-loser world. We won't go there, but it's in the book. It's in the book.
Richard, people wanted to experience more of your insight and wisdom and wonderful knowledge. How can they do that?
Well, there's a few ways that I'd love them to join in. I mean, you can just go have a look at the website, which is richardhill.com.au. I thought that was handy. I should be able to remember that. So that will take you to the work and look into the book and various aspects. There's lots of videos that you can find in there. There's the Facebook group, Mirroring Hands. I think it's a way of practice and a way of being. Very pretentious, but I was feeling poetic at the time, and you can't change anything once you've done it. But just go Mirroring Hands, search that, and there's lots of, you know, demonstrations. I'm not as sort of necessarily persistently online as some people are, but there's a lot of stuff there. Now, for those of you that are a bit science-minded as well, going to psychotherapy-minded, what we've got is I've got a six-hour video training program, which is based on the book and kind of gets you through the theory and through some practicals and gives you a really good framework. Eventually, I'll be out again doing live workshops, so that'll be the next thing. But keep in mind there, you know, put your go to the website and give me your email so you can find out about it. But this great six-hour video training program, and I think we had that out for, you know, 100 and something bucks.
Very reasonably priced when it was.
Which is very well. Now it's even better.
First came out, and it was like, this is extraordinary value.
Well, yeah, thanks for that. But now it's even better, because we've actually put it into the other project I do, the Science of Psychotherapy. So you can come in and just become a member of the Science of Psychotherapy, registered, which is $100 for a year.
Geez, that's good value.
And you can access the Mirroring Hands. You can access then 1,000 hours of information, articles, videos about neuroscience, about psychotherapy, all the stuff we've got from authors that we've had over the decade, last decade or so. And it's a fabulous place to come in and learn whatever you want. You'll see that there are we've broken it up, the whole bunch of resources everywhere, from the psychotherapies to the practice. And there's a little bit of stuff there, certainly from in the hypnotherapy. So have a, and then finally, so that's the scienceofpsychotherapy.net is there. The scienceofpsychotherapy.com, you can go in and access our podcasts, which we also do. So you'll find there's stuff there. Michael Yapko's done a few, and we've done things. But again, if you're interested a little bit more in some of those other areas of science. We've got it in spades. So there you go. That's how you can do stuff.
For those that are keen to get this book, it's a sizable volume. It's really comprehensive, this book. So
there's a shitload of stuff in that book.
And I should add that if you get the Audible version, Richard is narrating it himself.
I am the reader. So. And we try and give you a little bit of theoretical growth and then some experiential. Then a little bit more theoretical growth, then more experiential. And it was lovely. Eric, Roxana Eggerson Klein said, I love the way this book evolves and opens up and emerges along the way. So Ernie was pretty pleased with it too.
It's a wonderful read. It's absolutely brilliant. And so, yeah, hopefully if there's anyone listening to this who is only recently stepping into the world of hypnosis and discovering who they are as a hypnotist, then, you know, I would definitely say this book has to be on your book list to have a read.
Beautiful.
It's definitely up there. Richard, thank you so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, I just enjoyed, well, I did most of the talking, but I've loved your company, always have. So it's been very, very nice to spend some time with you.
To everyone watching, thank you so much for joining us. Please stay safe, and we look forward to seeing you next time around. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for watching the Confident Hypnotherapist podcast. I'd like to invite you, if you're on Facebook, to come and find us on the Hypnotherapist Networking Group. Particularly if you're a student or even if you're a seasoned hypnotherapist, you'll find a whole lot of information there regarding continued professional development that will help to build your confidence and effectiveness as a hypnotist. Come and join us. I look forward to seeing you there.